and I wish a very happy birthday on this February 23rd to three of our IRIS listeners. Happy birthday to Mona Ahrens of Rockwell, James Pat Carey of Nevada, and Lucille White, also of Nevada. Again, happy birthday to Mona Ahrens of Rockwell, James Pat Carey of Nevada, and Lucille White of Nevada. You're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service. If you're hearing us on your television or on Iowa PBS and you're not a registered IRIS listener, please give us a call here, 515-243-6833, so we can get you on our list. We need to know who's listening in order to help keep our services free. So now we'll turn it back to Barb for today's obituaries.
Okay, we start here with Maxine Lorraine Greek, 91, passed away peacefully on Wednesday, February 21, at home in Des Moines, surrounded by family. Maxine was born to Hazel Francisco Miller and Floyd Hampton Crawford in Byron, Wisconsin, on October 3 of 1932. She grew up alongside her sister, Carolyn Crawford, on their family Cranberry Marsh. In her early life, Maxine developed a love for horses and a strong work ethic that followed her throughout her life. Following graduation from high school, Maxine pursued her degree in nursing at the University of Tennessee, Memphis. She met William Greek at the University of Tennessee, and they married December 1953. Maxine and William welcomed their daughters Kathy in 1953, followed by Becky in 1958. Maxine dedicated over 40 years to the field of nursing. Beginning in pediatric nursing and later in her career, she stepped into administrative roles, including chief nursing officer at Humana in Kissimmee, Florida, and chief nursing officer at Humana in College Station, Texas. Maxine financed her career as the volunteer manager at Mercy Hospice in Des Moines. She enjoyed caring for her family, quilting, learning, and teaching her children and grandchildren. Her patience, fairness, quiet strength, and unconditional support were inspirational to her family and all who knew her. In lieu of flowers, memorial contributions may be made to the University of Tennessee Foundation to support a nursing scholarship in Maxine's name. In Polk City, William Sachse, S-A-C-H-S-E, Sr., 79, of Polk City, Iowa, passed away peacefully in his home on February 19th. He was a beloved father and grandfather. He's survived by son William Sachse, Jr., whose wife is Nicole, his daughter Jennifer, and stepson, and his 11 grandchildren. William worked at John Deere as a tool and die maker for 34 years and was also a farmer with a wide range of talents. He was a skilled woodworker and painter in addition to being an avid gardener. He enjoyed being outdoors. He spent time hunting and fishing with his children and grandchildren. He will be missed. Private memorial will be held for friends and family. Shaughnessy Michael Boone of Gallatin. Shaughnessy Boone, age 51, of Gallatin, Tennessee, passed away on Thursday, February 8, 2024. He was born on February 19 of 72 to his parents Ron and Charlotte Boone in Des Moines, Iowa. Shaughnessy was in the graduating class of 1990 of Waukee High School in Waukee, Iowa, and he then attended Northern Arizona University, where he attained his bachelor's degree. Shaughnessy worked as an IT manager for Vanderbilt Hospital, and in his personal time, Shaughnessy was a man with many hobbies. He was a great cook, avid bicyclist. He ran the Boone Shine Family Christmas Light Show in his neighborhood. He was also a member of the Rehoboth United Methodist Church in Gallatin. And Shaughnessy was a loving husband, father, and son who will be dearly missed. He was preceded in death by his mother, Charlotte Ann Patterson Boone, and maternal mother, Viola Patterson, and paternal grandparents, Bernard and Lucy Boone. In Iowa City, John Allen Tomei, 47, of Iowa City, passed away Sunday, February 18, 2024, and his loss was unexpected, and his family is profoundly saddened. He was their foundation. John was born August 9, 1976, in Iowa City, the son of Alan and Sally Frank Tomei. His youth was filled with friends, sports, and mischief. His friendships formed over a love of Babe Ruth, or while riding bikes through the neighborhood, were his most treasured. As with many Iowa City-born kids, John had a complicated relationship with his beloved Iowa Hawkeyes. After graduating from Regina High School in 1995, John checked his Travel the World boxes. With his friends, John went backpacking through Europe, skydiving in New Zealand, and made questionable yet incredible memories. John graduated from Kirkwood Community College with an associate degree before starting his career in construction. He worked with his dad, worked on his own, and even spent time out east with Beezer Homes before becoming construction project manager at the University of Iowa. He was a hard worker, often stubborn, and always determined to do things his own way, all of which was possible until he met his partner, Maggie Baker. She pushed him, challenged him, and together gave him his true purpose in life, his three children. Nellie Grace, Patrick John, and Sophia Ann were the greatest gifts from God. They were his world, and John loved them with his whole heart. John's unconditional love, strength of spirit, and unending faith were truly showcased in the way he cared for his entire family, including his brother Eric and sister Laurie and all his nieces and nephews. John was blessed to come from two large families who filled his childhood with love, a love that he later shared with his own children. A visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Friday, February 23, 2024, at St. Patrick Catholic Church in Iowa City, Iowa, with a rosary recited at 3:30 p.m. A mass of Christian burial will be held at 10 a.m. Saturday, February 24, at the church. Private interment will be held at St. Joseph Catholic Cemetery, and in lieu of flowers, memorials may be made to the John Tomei Memorial Fund, which will be used for his children. Online condolences may be left to the family at Lensing Funeral, L-E-N-S-I-N-G, funeral.com.
Continuing on with some national news now on page 4A of today's Register, the headline, Biden mocks Trump and calls Putin a crazy SOB. This story by Joey Garrison of the USA Today. Dateline Washington. President Joe Biden called Russian President Vladimir Putin a crazy SOB, and he mocked former President Donald Trump for comparing his legal troubles to the death of Putin dissident Alexei Navalny during a private fundraiser Wednesday in San Francisco. Biden told supporters, after bringing up Trump likening his situation to the plight of Navalny, who died last Friday under mysterious circumstances in a Russian prison, Biden said, If I stood here 10 to 15 years ago and said all of this, you'd all think I should be committed. Trump, the frontrunner for the presidential nomination on the Republican side, said in a social media post this week that Navalny's sudden death made him more aware of his own political rivals and court cases. During a Fox News town hall Tuesday, Trump called a New York judge's decision that he pay $355 million for fraudulently overvaluing his real estate empire, quote, a form of Navalny, unquote. Biden has blamed Putin for Navalny's death. Trump has not. Biden, speaking at the same fundraiser, referred to Putin as a crazy SOB while discussing the threat of climate change. Biden said, "We have a crazy SOB like that guy Putin and others, and we always have to worry about nuclear conflict, but the existential threat to humanity is climate." The United States has new intelligence that Russia hopes to put a nuclear weapon in space to target satellites. But White House officials have said it does not pose an immediate danger. Biden's remark drew a rebuke from the Kremlin. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said, "Such boorish statements from the mouth of a U.S. leader are hardly capable of hurting the head of another country in any way, much less President Putin." Peskov continued, "But it is a great shame for the country itself. It is clear that Mr. Biden is demonstrating Hollywood cowboy behavior to cater to domestic political interests." Putin is nearly 2 years into his war in Ukraine. President Biden is seeking $60 billion in assistance from Congress to aid Ukraine, but House Republicans have refused to bring the bill to the floor. Biden, who is known to go off script at fundraisers without television cameras around, said modern-day congressional Republicans are worse than the segregationists he worked alongside as a U.S. senator from Delaware, including the late Senator Strom Thurmond of South Carolina. Biden said, "I have been a senator since 1972. I have served with real racists. I've served with Strom Thurmond. I've served with all these guys that have set a terrible record on race." Biden said this at a second fundraiser in San Francisco. He said, "But guess what? These guys are worse. These guys do not believe in basic democratic principles." Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson, a Republican from Louisiana, called Biden's remarks outrageous. He said, "The least popular president to seek re-election is now so desperate and so underwater in the polls, he's playing the race card from the bottom of the deck." That's what Johnson wrote in a post on X.
And another Biden article here, cities considering new executive action on the border. And this is Joey Garrison writing. President Joe Biden is considering new executive actions to crack down on record migration at the southern border after congressional Republicans this month blocked White House-backed border legislation. A Biden administration official who spoke to USA Today on the condition of anonymity stressed that no final decisions have been made regarding that additional executive actions could be taken, if any. However, the Associated Press reported that the Biden administration is looking at provisions of federal immigration law routinely tapped by former President Donald Trump. Biden, according to the AP, is considering potential action under Section 212 of the 1952 Immigration and Nationality Act, which allows the president to deny immigration for anyone deemed detrimental to the interests of the United States. Such a move could invite a backlash from progressives and immigration advocates. The New York Times reported that Biden's executive order would restrict migrants' ability to claim asylum in the U.S. if they crossed the border illegally, a similar goal as the bipartisan border bill that congressional Republicans blocked. The legislation would have given the Department of Homeland Security the power to shut down the border to migrants when daily numbers met certain thresholds. In December, the U.S. Border Patrol had more than 250,000 encounters with migrants crossing into the U.S. from Mexico, according to the U.S. Customs and Border Protection statistics. That was the highest monthly total on record. The number of people crossing illegally into the U.S. from Mexico dropped by 50% in January, according to CBP. The border is emerging as the biggest issue for voters heading into the 2024 presidential election. And according to a recent poll by the Pew Research Center, 8 in 10 U.S. adults say the government is doing a somewhat or very bad job dealing with the large number of migrants seeking to enter the U.S. at the border with Mexico. Nearly as many say the situation is either a crisis, 45%, or a major problem, 32%, for the U.S. There are also partisan differences in the way that the Americans view the reasons for migrants coming to the border, according to Pew. Close to 76% of Republicans say the belief that U.S. immigration policies will make it easy to stay in the country once they arrive is a major factor. About half as many Democrats, 39%, say the same. Democrats and Democratic-leaning independents are 30 percentage points more likely than Republicans and Republican-leaners to cite violence in migrants' home countries as a major reason. That would be 79% versus 49%. Since the demise of the border bill, Biden has hammered Republicans over with their inaction in a move to turn immigration, an issue in which Democrats are typically playing defense, into a win for his reelection campaign.
DeSantis is not in talks for a vice presidential role, according to the Trump campaign. The story by David Jackson of the USA Today, Dateline Lexington, South Carolina. So much for that Donald Trump, Ron DeSantis ticket. Trump aides said Thursday that DeSantis is not in the vice presidential discussion, especially after the Florida governor questioned the former president's criteria for picking a running mate. Trump campaign National Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt said, "Ron DeSantis failed miserably in his presidential campaign and does not have a voice in selecting the next vice president of the United States." Leavitt responded after news reports that DeSantis told supporters that Trump should not play identity politics with the running mate slot, presumably a reference to the fact that Trump has women and black candidates on his vice presidential list. DeSantis said on a conference call with supporters of his failed presidential bid, "Now we have a diverse Republican Party. I want everybody in the fold, don't get me wrong, but I don't want people representing 10 or 15% of the party being in the driver's seat." In reposting that NBC News report on the social media site X, Trump senior advisor Chris LaCivita referred to DeSantis as a sad little man. DeSantis' name surfaced in the running mate search during a Fox News town hall on Tuesday. Fox News host Laura Ingraham read off a list of names suggested by the audience, including DeSantis, and Trump did not discount any of them. The names included South Carolina U.S. Representative and former 2024 presidential candidate Tim Scott. Actually, I believe he is in the U.S. Senate, not a U.S. representative, so I'll correct that story. Businessman and ex-candidate Vivek Ramaswamy, former Hawaii U.S. Representative Tulsi Gabbard, Florida U.S. Representative Byron Donalds, and South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem. Trump has said he's also considering New York Representative Elise Stefanik. Trump does not yet have the Republican nomination locked up, as he is still opposed by former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley. The two square off Saturday, tomorrow, in the South Carolina Republican primary. In his talk with supporters, DeSantis suggested that he would never be seriously considered by Trump to be a running mate. He said they approach the job differently. He said, "So I would want somebody that if something happened, the people that voted us in would have been pleased to know that they're going to continue the mission," DeSantis said. That's according to NBC. DeSantis also added, "I'm not sure that those are going to necessarily be the criteria that Donald Trump uses. I have heard that they're looking more at identity politics. I think that's a mistake. I think you should just focus on who the best person for the job would be and then do that accordingly." Trump and DeSantis and their aides had a tense relationship before and after the Florida governor's presidential bid. DeSantis withdrew from the race after a distant second-place finish to Trump in the Iowa caucuses.
Harris slams Alabama's court ruling on frozen embryos. Washington, this is by Joy Garrison. Vice President Kamala Harris slammed the Alabama Supreme Court's decision that frozen embryos should be considered children under the state law, arguing the ruling is already having dangerous consequences for women in the state. "This decision is outrageous, and it is already robbing women of the freedom to decide when and how to build a family," Harris said Wednesday in a statement on X, formerly Twitter. The Alabama Supreme Court ruled that embryos created during in vitro fertilization are extrauterine children and legally protected like any other child. IVF advocates fear the ruling could eventually spread to other states and have far-reaching consequences for millions of Americans struggling to get pregnant. On Wednesday, the University of Alabama at Birmingham Health System paused all IVF procedures pending review. Alabama Fertility Services made the impossibly difficult decision to hold new IVF treatments due to the legal risk, according to a Thursday statement. About 2% of births a year in the U.S. involve IVF, a process by which multiple eggs are harvested, fertilized, and implanted to create a pregnancy. The court's ruling repeatedly invoked Christian faith and the Alabama Constitution, which specifically protects unborn children, although that has typically referred to a developing fetus inside a womb. Alabama adopted a near-total ban on abortions in 2022. This is exactly the type of chaos that we expected when the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade and paved the way for politicians to dictate some of the most personal decisions families can make, White House Press Secretary Karen Jean-Pierre said Tuesday. All across the country, women are being forced to grapple with the devastating consequences of action by Republican-elected officials. President Joe Biden's re-election campaign is running aggressively on restoring abortion rights following the Supreme Court's 2022 overturn of Roe v. Wade, which for five decades provided a constitutional right to an abortion. Harris has helped lead the charge on the Biden administration's efforts to protect abortion access. The Biden campaign, bracing for a likely general election rematch against Republican frontrunner Donald Trump, has worked to remind female voters that Trump's three Supreme Court appointments were instrumental in Roe's dismantling. The campaign this week seized on a New York Times report that Trump has privately expressed support for a national ban on abortion after 16 weeks of pregnancy. Nikki Haley, Trump's only remaining major Republican primary opponent, said Wednesday that she agreed with the Alabama Supreme Court's decision.
And this story from page 6A of today's Register: Biden dog bit people at least 25 times. New records show the extent of commander's damage. This story by the USA Today. President Joe Biden's now banished German Shepherd commander inflicted more damage with bites than previously known. Newly released records from the United States Secret Service to USA Today revealed the aggressive dog was involved in at least 25 biting incidents in less than 1 year. Previously, the conservative group Judicial Watch had revealed a tally of 10 biting incidents. This month, the Secret Service released 269 pages related to a Freedom of Information Act request that included email traffic with anecdotes of the dog bites. It included a table with the 23 incidents from October of 2022 to July of 2023. That does not include two more incidents in September and October that finally prompted commander's removal. In October, White House staff decided to relocate the two-year-old dog. Representatives from the White House did not answer questions this week about the incidents, but said the president and first lady care deeply about the safety of those who work at the White House and those who protect them every day. Elizabeth Alexander, a spokesperson for the First Lady, said, despite additional dog training, leashing, working with veterinarians, and consulting with animal behaviorists, the White House environment simply proved too much for Commander. Since the fall, he has lived with other family members. The list showed bites to Secret Service agents' arms, hands, thighs, back, wrists, elbows, waist, and chest, and an agent's ammunition magazine pouch. At least 11 of the incidents required medical attention. Records show the dog also bit White House staff and Navy staff. Commander's bites happened not only on the White House grounds, but on trips to Camp David in Maryland, Nantucket, Massachusetts, and Rehoboth Beach, Delaware. In one case last June, Commander bit an agent in the Jacqueline Kennedy Garden south of the White House's East Colonnade. It was captured on surveillance footage, which showed the dog racing at the agent and tackling him to the ground. The agent received a deep laceration that required stitches. East Wing tours were suspended that day while maintenance crews mopped up puddles of blood near the bookseller's room. In July, First Lady Jill Biden tried to call off the dog as it barked and bounded toward a special agent. He hit the agent in the left forearm and caused a deep open wound. The agent reported losing a significant amount of blood and received 6 stitches from the White House medical team. The agent's boss emailed him that they jokingly considered a care package of Advil, antibiotic cream, pepper spray, a muzzle, and some dog biscuits for safety purposes, but thanked him for staying on the job. Agents expressed concern the commander's behavior continued to cause a risk of serious injury and traded tips on how to not get tagged, as they call it. One agent wrote, "Standing tall and yelling his name and stop is your best bet not to get bit. Once I yelled at him and faced him, he turned around and started sniffing a bush." Last June, a senior Secret Service agent with the Presidential Protection Division thanked staff members for their patience during the string of dog bites and issued a warning. Quote, "The recent dog bites have challenged us to adjust our operational tactics when Commander is present. Please give lots of room, staying a terrain feature away if possible." Supervisor also suggested that doing so would run counter to the primary protection jobs. "We will continue to keep the president in our sight, but must be creative to ensure our own personal safety." Not everyone reacted so temperately. The records obtained by Judicial Watch detail an officer's reaction to his colleague being bit in November. After the attack, an officer who reached out to the hurt agent called the account freaking crazy and referred to Commander as "that stupid dog." "What a joke," the officer said. "If it wasn't their dog, he would have already been put down. Freaking clown needs a muzzle. I hope you get to feeling better." Secret Service spokesman Anthony Guglielmi reiterated this week that the department takes the safety and well-being of our employees extremely seriously. He said the incidents involving Commander were treated as workplace injuries, with events documented in accordance with Secret Service and U.S. Department of Homeland Security guidelines. "While Secret Service personnel," he wrote, "neither handle nor care for the first family's pets, we work continuously with all applicable entities in order to minimize any adverse impacts from family pets." Records show that at least one of the bite victims filed a federal injury claim requesting workers' compensation for the time off. Just a little more left in this amazing story. Dogs tend to be good public relations for first families, but the Bidens have struggled. Before Commander went on his biting spree, the Bidens had another German Shepherd named Major who had his own track record of bad behavior. The 3-year-old Major was shipped to live with family friends in 2021 after he bit 2 people in 1 month. At the time, spokespeople said the dog was having difficulty adjusting to the White House. Trainers agreed that the change was difficult, especially for a rescue dog. Major came from a shelter. Commander is purebred. Other trainers commented that indoor life can be tough for a young, energetic German Shepherd, and having multiple handlers can confuse canine communication. A third Biden family dog, Champ, died in 2021 at the age of 13. And probably the best solution of all, in 2022, the Bidens adopted a cat. Well, for the last 90 minutes, your readers have been Dave Buzik and Barb Martin, who's in the next studio laughing at me. It's been a pleasure to read for you. Now we'll take a short break to allow our next readers to get into place. Have a good weekend.
Welcome back. Your new readers are John McPartland and Jim Hoffman. We'll continue with articles from the Des Moines Register and USA Today. Here's Jim with your next article.
Thank you, John. And we're on the opinion page of the USA Today to start off with this morning. Good morning to everyone. This article written by Isha Sharma. She is a contributor, a first-generation Indian-American writer based in New York City, and a Case Western Reserve University and Georgetown University graduate. Stand with Oscar-nominated film against sexual violence. It's a universal truth, commonly unacknowledged, that there's an implicit set of rules women are conditioned to follow from a young age in order to remain safe. For centuries, we've been taught to adjust to a patriarchal society in which we are not considered fundamentally equal by changing our behavior or appearance to blend in, thwart unsolicited attention, and avoid danger. This is how it has been, but I refuse to believe this is how it must be. As Oscars voting begins, I urge members of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences to consider the nominated documentary To Kill a Tiger, which provides a stereoscopic view into the intersectional manifestations of sexual violence against women and girls in India. The documentary follows Kiran, 13, and her family in their village over more than a year. The opening scene, filmed in 2017, features a close-up of Kiran braiding her hair with colorful ribbons while a voiceover describes how she had been sexually assaulted by three men after a family wedding. One of the assailants was her cousin. A woman is raped every 16 minutes somewhere in India. Though legislation around women's rights and sexual assault in India has progressed in the past decade, spurred on in part by horrifyingly high-profile cases that sparked worldwide outrage, checks and balances are seemingly non-existent, with an overarching culture change lagging behind. In 2011, according to data released by the National Crime Records Bureau, a woman was raped every 20 minutes in India. By 2021, this rate increased to a woman every 16 minutes, with 31,677 cases registered, or 87 cases a day. According to the non-governmental organization Equality Now, most cases are never officially reported due to attitudes toward police officers who had turned away survivors, bribery and corruption, intrusive medical examinations, pressure to compromise or settle cases, low conviction rates, and lack of support services for survivors. Perhaps this is why I was taken aback by the fact that in To Kill a Tiger, Ranjit, a farmer, chose to support his daughter and filed a court case the next day. In an interview about her documentary, Emmy and Oscar-nominated Indian-Canadian director Nisha Pahuja told me, "If you think about the history of how change happens, there's always that one person that's willing to take a stand and speak the truth. That's Ranjit. In his community and even in India, there are so few men that actually will stand by their daughters. And here's this man that did it." Meanwhile, Ranjit and his family experienced backlash from other village members for disrupting the peace and going against the status quo. What was fascinating, though not surprising, were the justifications that the villagers, both men and women, used to excuse the predators for their actions. It was almost as if they had blinders on. They didn't want to see what they didn't want to see. While most of the villagers were sympathetic, or at least seemed uncomfortable by what had occurred, the majority thought that prosecution was unjust, that the village dynamics were in jeopardy, that the teen shouldn't have been out past midnight, and that the easiest way to remove the stain on her was to marry her off to one of the men who assaulted her. This type of groupthink is lethal if left unchecked, its adverse effects permeating for generations. At one point in the documentary, the female defense attorney representing the three accused men says in Hindu, "This isn't the West. Here I can't even trust my own son," implying that the onus is on village girls and women to keep themselves safe. Regarding such victim blaming that allows individuals to operate without fear of consequence, best-selling author Rupi Kaur told me, "The first thought wouldn't be to defend the perpetrator, whether they're a man or a woman. The first thought should always be to ask the survivor what they need and hold the perpetrator responsible." Kaur is among the executive producers of To Kill a Tiger documentary. Others include writer-actor Mindy Kaling, actor Dev Patel, and surgeon-writer Atul Gawande. "Unless men become increasingly involved, nothing is going to change," added director Pahuja, who's made a career out of advocating for gender parity and human rights. "For too long, as women, we've been carrying the burden of equality on our shoulders when we weren't the problem. The issue is patriarchy and masculinity." But to dismantle an entire system, there must be a revolution of consciousness, one where human beings recognize their individual roles in upholding a patriarchal society that tolerates sexual violence and oppresses women. In order to reduce a sexual assault to, we all need to be a part of the conversation. We all live in a shared anxiety society, which means all members have to join the cause to stop the violence, Kaur said. How can we expect half the population to empathize with survivors if they're not at the table discussing with us? In the final minutes of To Kill a Tiger, we witness the traumatized Kiran turn hopeful and her exhausted father in buoyant repose. Despite all odds, together they've won. After a 14-month trial, the perpetrators were sentenced to 25 years in prison for sexual assault. With a hint of pride and a glimmer and a smile, Ranjit states, "I said I would kill the tiger, and I did." In an Oscars race where large budget films regularly dominate, a rare cinematic triumph that showcases what happens when we believe in girls and women warrants center stage.
Okay, the next opinion piece we have is from Brittany Stewart. Brittany Stewart is a journalist and lives in Virginia after moving from Alabama 4 years ago. "Each night when I tuck my nearly 5-year-old girl into bed, I tell her she is pure magic. Her sweet nature, her big feelings, her brilliant problem-solving skills, and her impeccable timing was no accident. She was fearfully and wonderfully made in Alabama using in vitro fertilization. Due to my husband's military service, forcing us to live separately in our prime fertility years, we became one of the countless couples in our social groups who struggled to conceive. Although we have since moved to Virginia, the embryo that could be my second child is still in Alabama, where the state Supreme Court has ruled 7-2 that frozen embryos are considered children under the law and that their destruction could amount to wrongful death. We have been unsure about when or how we wanted to grow our family again, but this astounding court decision may have drastically limited our options moving forward. By conferring personhood status on our last frozen embryo, these judges have made us wonder if we can be charged with murder if we try to implant it, but the pregnancy does not succeed. We are not alone. This ruling has delivered a gut punch to the 1 in 6 adults globally struggling with infertility. We did not choose IVF on a whim. In fact, I agonized over the decision because I feel so called so strongly to the missions of foster parenting and adoption. What you find out when you cannot conceive normally is that there are no good options. My husband's deployment schedule made fostering requirements nearly impossible for us. Adoption could have cost twice as much, with no guarantee of success either. Ultimately, what I wanted most was for my father to meet his grandchild before he died of colon cancer. 3 years after surgeries and other treatments made clear that IVF was our most promising option. Because of carefully monitored and conservative stimulation protocols from an incredible medical team, our IVF cycle created 3 embryos. One of those was successfully planted in my uterus and grew into my amazing daughter. IVF was expensive. It was physically and emotionally scarring. It raised moral questions for us about the effort to create a life, but it was our choice. An extremely careful, considered choice, having the benefit of decades of scientific data and the wisdom and talents of a medical team we trust implicitly. This court decision equating frozen embryos with living children could make IVF even more inaccessible to other would-be parents. This dangerous precedent could lead to lawsuits and legislation throughout the country that effectively bars others from utilizing a medical procedure that helped us meet our daughter. In the United States, 2 of every 100 babies are born through IVF. This process, available for 4 decades here, has assisted in bringing to life countless cherished children. The IVF process aims to create multiple embryos in the hopes that at least one will be genetically viable. Given the time, physical challenges, and significant expense involved in using IVF to achieve a pregnancy, having multiple embryos is a lucky outcome. We felt very fortunate to have had 3. By criminalizing their destruction, these judges may have barricaded this path to having a baby at all, an ironic outcome for people allegedly motivated by a concern for life. Beyond the direct threat to the process of IVF, these justices have raised many more questions to which they provide no clear guidance. What happens to my frozen embryo in Alabama now? What if the doctor whom I'd followed to the moon, if she told me there was a baby waiting for me, decides it's no longer safe for her to offer reproductive medicine in the state? Make no mistake, Alabama's highest court has effectively handcuffed one of the most brilliant fertility doctors in the country with a decision that will make it near impossible for her to help other families as she has mine. Further, if we decide to implant our last embryo and the pregnancy fails, will she face criminal charges? Will we? In 2022, we tried to implant another embryo, but the pregnancy was not successful. In trying to create a life, is the Alabama Supreme Court now saying that we killed a child? With the birth of our daughter, my husband and I have felt for the first time in 20 years we've known each other that we are truly living. To see the wonder of the world through the child's eyes, an experience that cannot be adequately expressed in words. We hope to see her in the role of big sister someday. Alabama's elected justices taking away this opportunity for her and others is unthinkable. We call on lawmakers across the country, those who really put families first, to safeguard IVF for all of us.
Thanks, John. Turning to sports, in the Des Moines Register, we have the sports schedule on TV for today. I'll hit some of those that you might be interested in. Auto racing at 2 p.m. on FS1, we have the NASCAR Craftsman Truck Series. And at 4 o'clock, the NASCAR Xfinity Series. College baseball on the Major League Baseball Network, 3 o'clock, Andre Dawson Classic, Alabama State against Southern University. And then at 6:30, also from the Andre Dawson Classic, Grambling State versus Florida A&M. College basketball, a pretty good slate here. At 5 o'clock on CBS Sports Network, Kent State at Akron. 6 o'clock, ESPNU, Toledo at Bowling Green. At 7:30 on ESPN2, Duquesne against Fordham. And then at 8 o'clock, ESPNU, Fairfield at Quinnipiac. And on FS1 at 9 o'clock, Nevada plays San Jose State. There's one college women's game on at 9 o'clock in the Pac-12, Colorado against Southern Cal. College hockey, we have 7 o'clock on BTN, Notre Dame's at Michigan. And on CBS Sports Network, Western Michigan's at St. Cloud State. College wrestling, ACC Network at 6. Virginia Tech is at NC State. And NBA basketball tonight, 6:30 on ESPN. Cleveland's at Philadelphia. And at 9 o'clock, Milwaukee on ESPN at Minnesota. We have an article here, the Register's Athletes of the Week. Written by Joe Randleman of the Register. Worley Muller are named the Register's Athletes of the Week. Cedar Rapids Prairie girls basketball player Kiana Worley and Osage boys wrestler Mac Muller were voted the Des Moines Register's Iowa Ortho Female and Male Athlete of the Week winners for the week of February 12th to the 18th. Worley won Female Athlete of the Week with 40% of the vote. Estherville Lincoln Central girls basketball player Haley Stokes came in second with 32%. Worley led Prairie to a 53-48 victory over Linmar during the 5A regional semifinals Saturday at Cedar Rapids. The talented freshman went for 22 points after making 5 of 10 field goals, 3 of 4 three-pointers, and all 9 of her free throws. She chipped in 2 steals on defense. Muller won Male Athlete of the Week with 58%. Fort Dodge boys wrestler Drashawn Ross took second with 23%. Muller helped Osage claim the 2A team championship at the Boys State Wrestling Tournament by taking first at 285. Muller finished a perfect 52-0 on the season after defeating Columbus WMU's Russell Kroll in the 2A title match at 285 by an 8-3 decision.
Thank you, Jim. We now have a story on the Drake men's. DeVries scores 21 in Drake's win over Belmont. Tucker DeVries took some contact as he launched a three-point shot toward the net during Wednesday's matchup between Drake basketball and Belmont. The Bruins bullion didn't faze DeVries, who sank the shot and increased his point total to over 20 for the fourth time in the last 5 games. In a battle between 2 of the top small forwards in the conference, DeVries and Belmont's Cade Tyson, the Bulldogs junior separated himself from the crowd. "There's a lot of great players, and every night you're going against somebody that has a lot of talent," DeVries said. "He's certainly one of those players. But with winning top of mind, individual success mattered a little less. Even DeVries' buckets were the driving force in the Bulldogs' 85-69 win over Belmont. Drake improved to 23-5 on the season and 14-3 in conference play. The Bulldogs are assured of a first-round bye in Arch Madness for the 4th straight year and 6th time in the last 7 years. "Our focus right now is just each individual game and trying to win the next one, said Drake coach Darian DeVries. Tonight, we turn the page and head to Cedar Falls for what's always a tough and competitive game. The Bruins crushed Drake 87-65 in January. Darian DeVries mentioned that looking at the film from the last matchup ruined the mood, but that his team didn't overreact to the loss. While the Bulldogs didn't focus on that game throughout the season, they did take some of that loss into Wednesday's contest. Last time we played them, we weren't the same team we are now. We just had a terrible game. It was focusing on the defense. If a team smacks us at their home by 30, we got to get our back at some point. We had a good crowd today, and it was very entertaining. If there is one Belmont player who rarely leaves the court, it's Tyson. He leads the Bruins with 32.4 minutes per game, and that total is the 15th most across the Missouri Valley Conference. He started the game as usual, then subbed out once around the 10-minute mark of the first half, returning a few minutes later. But after picking up his first personal of the game, foul trouble landed Tyson on the bench for the final 6 minutes of the opening frame. Tyson didn't start the second half, and he re-entered the game after 4 minutes ticked off the clock. He remained in the game on and off for most of the final frame, but couldn't get back into typical form. The Belmont small forward finished with 8 points and 6 rebounds. All that credit just goes to Kevin Overton, Tucker DeVries said. He had the assignment most of the night, and tonight we didn't do anything too special. I think KO just stepped up to the challenge and took it personal and did a great job. This isn't a new concept for the Bulldogs. Drake's assist-to-turnover ratio, 1.61, is the best in the league, and those skills were on full display against the Bruins. The Bulldogs recorded 16 assists and had 7 turnovers. The Bulldogs' ability to hang on to the ball on offense and cause turnovers on defense proved vital, especially as Drake shut down a key part of Belmont's game. The Bruins lead the MVC with 7.63 steals per game. On Wednesday, Drake allowed Belmont to steal the ball only 3 times and didn't give up a single steal in the first half. The last time we played them, we had 15 turnovers, Darian DeVries said. It's hard to win when you turn the ball over that many times. Coming out at halftime, we had 1 turnover, which is a terrific turnaround. Overall, we did a really nice job taking care of the basketball. The Bulldogs take the court again Saturday when they take on UNI in Cedar Falls at 5 p.m.
Thanks, John, and it's time for Dear Abby. First letter, Dear Abby, I suffered an injury that caused internal bleeding, which then gave me deficiency anemia. I was battling its symptoms of depression and anxiety before I was diagnosed. Never having had any mental health struggles in my life, I had no idea what was happening to me. I was happy and calm my whole life until this medical condition changed my behavior considerably. My wife of 20 years left me. I was diagnosed with the iron deficiency anemia after she had left. After the diagnosis, I was able to stop my blood loss and cure the anemia. Its symptoms went away and I returned to my normal self. I was sure my wife and I would reconcile after my diagnosis, but she says I was using the illness as an excuse for my behavior. She doesn't understand it was the cause. She mistakenly believes I'm permanently mentally ill. She doesn't understand that these symptoms went away once the illness was cured. She says it brought out my true personality, which is not true. My wife and family are my whole life. I didn't get this medical condition on purpose. We have a 4-year-old daughter. I am a great father, too. My wife is throwing away our family and trying to take my daughter away from me because I had a curable illness, which I no longer have. How can I get her to understand what happened and save our family? Signed, Saddest Man in the World. Dear Saddest Man, you can't force your wife to reconcile, but it would be beneficial to both of you to consult your physician so he or she can explain the reason for your personality change and assure her the problem is not permanent. If that doesn't help, then you will have to accept that the marriage is over for the most tragic of reasons and go on with your life. I'm so sorry for your predicament. And then the second letter, Dear Abby, my husband died 2 years ago. It's been a struggle, but we are making it. I have 2 sons. One is on his own. The other's in middle school. I want to move back to my hometown, but my son wants to stay high school like his brother did. I don't have anything holding me here besides my job. I'm so sad and depressed. Moving back home with friends and family closer would be better for me, but maybe not better for him. Losing his dad has been really hard on him. It will be 4 years before he finishes school. I just want to be a good mom. Please advise me. Signed, Not Sure in South Carolina. Abby writes, Dear Not Sure, do not move your son while he's in his last year or two at the middle school. By then, cliques have formed, and he may find it difficult to fit in at the new school. The time to make that move would be the summer before your son's freshman year of high school, because at that time, every student will be entering a new environment and be on more equal footing socially. It couldn't hurt to discuss this with a counselor at your son's school and ask for suggestions.
That brings us to the end of the Des Moines Register for today. I'm John McPartland, and my partner at the microphone has been Jim Hoffman. Earlier, you heard Barb Martin and Dave Busick. You can listen to IRIS programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. Support for today's readings comes from the Des Moines Register, Iowa Public Radio, Iowa PBS, and bensoundmusic.com. Thank you for listening to IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.